started to happen, this was gonna happen.
You thought running was gonna be good.
How long do you want me to go to, man?
9:55.
You know, like I said, I'm Jeter. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic, cocaine addict.
Hey, Jeter.
I will start off by saying that, God damn, my heart race. It's not because I'm standing, that's because I tried to run. I ran, I need to like stretch. No, you know, my sobriety date is March 28, 2010. And I do have a sponsor, Greg. Greg S., he's been sober, just picked up 5 years, and he has a sponsor, Melvin. He's got 22, Tony Dubs. Melvin's got a sponsor, I can't remember what his name is, but he's got like 34 years. And my sponsorship family comes out of the Heavy Hitters, which is an all-male Alcoholics Anonymous meeting down on the east side. And you know, these guys have really taught me how to live a new life. And you know, something Melvin, my grand sponsor, pushes with me a lot that I've heard him share is that from the ages of 2 and 12 is when I really started feeling the way I felt that led me to my drink. You see what I'm saying? Lonely, defiant, obsessive, always wanting more, you know, telling lies and stuff like that. he winked at me, kind of thing. And when he told me that, I was like, damn, you know, because when I look back at those ages, man, as soon as I picked up my first drink, all those feelings went away from those ages. And, you know, growing up, you know, I was talking to my pops today about my childhood, and he said I was a real easy kid growing up. You know, I put myself to bed, you know, I took care of myself while they were at work. You know, I went places on my own. I stayed the night out on my own. I did things on my own, you know. And I grew up in a real hardworking family, you know, lower middle class. It's just everyday life. My parents treated me wonderfully. I'm an only child. They played me out. You know, got married, stayed together for a couple of years and had me. You know, couldn't ask for nothing better. And growing up, I was real big about being my own person, you know, real big on the soccer field. My pops was a soccer coach. And that's what I live for. You know, I grew my hair out long like he had it. You know, couldn't nobody tell me nothing. I was my own person. And I remember I started hanging out with this group of older kids because I was always around older people since he worked at a college. I was always interacting with his players and hanging out with them and going on the women's games on the weight bus and curling up in their lap because I was little. And I was never really shy, you know. And I started hanging out with this older bunch, and they always tried to get me to drink. And I said, no, I'm never going to drink. And then I started drinking. And I didn't really get drunk. And I remember the first time I got drunk, you know, I stopped. And all I remember was I was at this house way out in the country, and there was this grown-ass man named Huckleberry out there. And he was this big, fat dude. And I've never seen him since. But I remember drinking a 22-ounce Smirnoff Ice.
Oh.
Judge me now. I was walking down this hallway and I stopped and I said, this is what it feels like to be drunk. You know, and it wasn't necessarily I have arrived, but it's like I can have one thought at one time. You see what I'm saying? I can think about one thing at a time. Because I had an obsessive mind growing up. If I saw someone die on television, I would think about death for a whole week. And my dad would come in and I'd be crying in my room with the lights on under the covers. I don't want to die. I don't want to die at 6 and 7 years old. You see what I'm saying? And I started drinking, and you know, we did country shit. We lassoed mailboxes, hit stuff with beer bottles, you know? And I blacked out and threw up. I got drunk that day. I got drunk the next day, and I'm in the backseat of the car chilling, jamming. And we hit a speed bump, and I threw up into the windshield. That was an everyday thing for me. And I thought that was normal to black out and to go places and not remember what happened and to get sick and to wake up in closets and to sleep on picnic tables on sewer drains and have to go to lake accesses and go to sleep because you can't go home to your parents. You see, I thought that was normal. And then I started getting into the drugs. And granted, I was one of them kids that said, I drink, but I'm never going to smoke weed. Then I started smoking weed. I'm never going to pop pills. Then I started popping pills, so on and so forth, you know, until I found cocaine. And cocaine was the drug that really slowed my mind down, that really made me feel like I fit in. You could have filled this whole room up and then some with the amount of friends I've had my whole life and never felt like I fit into that group of friends, you know. And right before I found cocaine, we moved to a neighborhood where majority of the people who lived in this neighborhood were of the poverty level. They fixed up a couple houses, and we could finally afford to buy our own house, so we went and moved over there. And I related to these kids a lot more than I did some of my other friends in school. You know, I related to sitting around wondering what we was going to eat, you know, what we going to do for fun. You know, and granted, they was all selling crack, shooting dice, living this lifestyle of just defiance, police everywhere and stuff like that. And I jumped into that full force. I remember the first night we lived there, I saw this cop chasing this guy, and he got out of the car and ran, and I was so glad he got away. You know what I'm saying? I was happy for him. And then the third day I lived there, I saw these two dudes beat up this crackhead, and I was like, damn, you know, that's cool. You know what I mean? And it's not cool. But at the time, I thought it was. You know, I fit into this lifestyle. And I jumped into that lifestyle full force, and that's when I started, you know, hustling, and that was my ways of getting money. And I wasn't about going to school. You know, I went to school to find people to get high with, to find people to make money off of, and slept through class and still managed to graduate with flying colors. And I went to work, and if I couldn't hustle from the job, then I wouldn't work it, and I quit, you know. And I got arrested. You know, everybody knows the story. Everybody had the stuff happen to them, you know, and then that's when I found cocaine. And then within 2 months of using cocaine, I had lost 30 pounds, and I honestly felt trapped, you know. And then I got arrested again and put into drug court. And that was the first time I stepped into a 12-step meeting. And I was 17 years old, and I picked up a 30-day chip first, which is kind of backwards, and then picked my white chip up when I had like 6 months. I don't know, it really was crazy. But I participated, I got a sponsor, but as soon as I saw that 4-step, I'm like, nah, Pep, I'm in high school, like I gotta do homework already. I'm not fixing to write nothing, you know. And I sat down and told him, I'm like, look, bro, you know, I'm not done getting high, and I started back drinking, you know. And I got into this relationship right before I started back drinking in college. And this was the first real relationship I had ever been in, you know, where I'm telling somebody I love them and I'm caring about them, you know. And she had a lot of childhood issues. She had put those secrets into me. And I said, well, I'm gonna be the guy who saves this girl. I'm gonna be the guy who never treats this girl this way, you know what I mean? And I needed her. I drifted away from the 12-step program and put all my faith into her. And then I started back drinking, you know. And I was laid up in the room with her one night, and I looked at her and I said, well, baby, I'm gonna run down here to these frat houses and get a cigarette, I'm gonna be right back. You know, I went down there, I got a cigarette, I'm sitting there watching the party, this dude hands me a beer, you know, I'm just gonna have one beer, that's all I'm gonna have. By the end of the night, I only drank 14 or 15 beers and I'm blacked out. And I come back to the room. You know, a long story short, I come up from my blackout, standing there in my drawers, and I just know I'm in trouble. I don't know what happened, I just know I'm in trouble. I walk back across campus in my drawers, go to sleep, piss the bed, wake up and go to work. And I was a high school official at the time, and I was refereeing this game, and this girl walked up to me, and she said, you know, I heard about you and old girl splitting up. I said, what you mean? What you talking about? Last time I checked, we was on point, you know what I mean? And she said, no, you put your hands on her last night, and my stomach dropped, you know what I mean? And it still gives me chills to this day to even say that. And that was something that was on my 4-step that I swore I would never admit to. I was a violent sleeper as a child, and I'd get up in my sleep and try to hit my mom, and I was all asleep, and I blamed it on that. And when I finally worked the 5th step, I finally admitted to that, and that was one of the biggest burdens that was lifted off my chest. You see what I'm saying? Because everybody was on my side. Didn't nobody hear it. Nobody saw it. She didn't have no marks on her, you know, but she said I smushed her and pushed her and stuff like that. And to be this guy I said I would never be. You know, I watched my father treat my mother so well my whole life. And to be this person and to do it and not know it. And then on top of that, to be the guy that I said I was going to protect her from. It crushed me. And I jumped headfirst back into drugs and alcohol. And I continued to use and drink the only way I knew how, which was nonstop all day long. I got arrested a couple more times, got incarcerated a couple times. You know, I was playing soccer at LaGrange College for my pops, and failed a drug test, got suspended, came back and had to take another drug test to get back on the team, and I could not stop getting high. I wanted to so bad, but I couldn't. And I failed that drug test, and you know, he looked at me, he said, I've been coaching here for 21 years, and you're the only person who has ever got suspended for failing a drug test. And I was like, damn. And that hurt. That was big for me, because I grew up on that soccer field. I'm living the dream, you know what I'm saying? I'm playing for my father, I'm playing in college, I'm scoring goals, I'm in the paper. And I'm going to drug court class, and I'm in the paper all at the same time. Like, what, judge? You know, you see this? I ain't no drunk, I'm in the paper, you know what I mean? All these people are like 50. With alcohol shit on their leg, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not like them, but I was, you know, at the age of 19, 20, 17, my whole life. And life continued to carry on. You know, I got incarcerated, I got out of jail, went back, got arrested again. Everybody knows the story, it happened to everybody. And I got more and more involved in that lifestyle, and I remember I met this guy when I was locked up. And he called me when he got out, and he was like, you know, come hook me up with this. And I was like, no, man, like, you're killing me. He's like, all y'all motherfuckers in jail talk about y'all can do this, and this, and y'all don't ever do it. And it made me mad. It hurt my pride. Like, no, I wasn't sitting in that line. You know, I'm on my way. And I took it to him. And the next thing you know, I got a gun to my head. Never interact with someone you meet in jail. Just bad idea. But I got a gun to my head, and all I'm thinking about is, if he takes everything I own, how can I get high? That's all I kid you not, that is all I thought about. I never once thought about my life. Never once thought about what happens. He took the gun off me and put it on my partner, and I said, no, brother, put the gun back on me. He ain't do nothing. I ain't care if he kill me. You see what I'm saying? I was already having, you know, if I had a gun, would I kill myself? You know, do I want to jump off a bridge? Do I want to do that? And my solution to my suicidal thoughts was just to get high. And then just the cycle kept going. And by this time, you know, I'm in the bed praying, you know, God, please don't let me get fucked up tomorrow. Please. And I'm meaning it. And you know, like Bob says all the time, you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test and I would have passed it. I did not want to get high. But I didn't know how to start. You know, and I ended up going to jail like 3 times in a month, and my parents were going to send me off to treatment, and they take my cell phone. Well, my cell phone is the root to everything. It's where I'm getting all, everybody's calling me. That's why everything happens on my phone. He takes my phone, he won't give it back. And I'm running through the house, slamming shit, throwing shit, and he picks me up and puts me against the wall. He looks at me as if I was a stranger breaking into his house. And granted, this is the man I wanted to be like as a child. This was my best friend. And I'm not one of those people who just says my dad's my best friend just to say that shit. He really is. We are just the same. And he is a person who we strive to be in the programs. He's naturally humble. He's naturally open-minded. Never, you know, never seen him drunk, never done a drug. If there's a man walking with a gas can, he picks him up. That's who I want to be like. And this man's got me against the wall, looking at me like he wants to hit me in the mouth. And I stepped into the bathroom. Damn. And I stepped into the bathroom, and I just started slamming my head on the mirror, because I just wanted to go to the hospital, go somewhere besides there, just wanted everything out of my mind. And I thought the mirror was going to break, but it didn't. And I had this big old knot on my head, and I was bleeding, and for the first time in my whole life, I did not know what to do. I was the type of person that always had a plan, always knew what was best for me, and I didn't know what to do. So I got high, right? With a knot on my fucking head. And, you know, I ended up coming into treatment, you know, and I try to speed through this and into the work. You know, I came into treatment. I wanted to stop snorting cocaine. If I had to quit the other stuff, cool. But I got back into that mindset where I know what's best for me. You know, I thought women were gonna fix me. Tried that, didn't work. Tried it for a long time, it didn't work. You know, I thought being a clown was gonna fix me, didn't work. You know, got me put out of treatment center sober. I thought shopping was gonna fix me, made me broke, didn't work. Thought gambling was gonna fix me, never won. Dead ass serious. And I ended up changing sponsors. And I was on the verge of getting kicked out of like my fourth treatment center sober. And I'm facing all this time in jail, which I'm not even worried about because it's like, fuck it, I'll go to Alabama. You know what I mean? And he looks at me, and I'm on the phone with him, and I'm just like, dude, I do not know what to do. And he's like, you know, it's your freedom, Jeter. And it was more than just freedom from the law. It was my freedom from drugs, my freedom from alcohol, my freedom from living this awful life. He said, it's yours. What are you going to do to keep it? And that's when I started doing the work. You know, and he took me through doctor's opinion where I learned that I have a physical allergy, a mental obsession. I learned, you know, like Danny was saying, that the alcoholic life is what's normal to me. To hustle and steal and lie and cheat is what's normal. To womanize is what's normal. To get other people to fix me is what's normal. And I can't differentiate the truth from the false. He told me, and I live by this to this day, do not believe everything you think. He told me that. And I was like, word. And then we went into the Bill story. And he made me outline Bill's story. Similarities and differences. And when you have more similarities to the cat that made the book, you're probably an alcoholic. I'm just saying. And I related a lot to Bill's story. And we went into there's a solution, you know, where I learned that just because I'm a drug addict like Bob isn't enough to keep me and Bob together. To know that the same solution can fix both me and Bob and we can do it together keeps me and Bob together. Because I would never hang with Bob on the street. And he always says that about me, and this is my chance to say that about him. And that's what I learned from there's a solution. And there's a lot more in that chapter, but I'm trying to get into towards the end. And then I went into more about alcoholism, where I learned that self-knowledge will not fix me. And I was like, damn, because I thought I had all the answers to myself. And this chapter teaches me that self-knowledge, self-power, willpower won't fix me. And it tells me that if I want to test whether or not I'm alcoholic, I can pick up a drink and try to stop. Or I can quit for a whole year with nothing else. And those two things scared the shit out of me. I was like, I don't even need to try them. I'm straight. And they scared me to death, man. And, you know, we went into We Agnostics. And my favorite part in We Agnostics is where it tells me that I find my God within myself. The last place I looked, you know. And I was praying just because other cats was praying, you know, and I was seeing them change. But I remember I was begging God for some patience and tolerance because when I came in, I mumbled, like you couldn't understand me. Like I would mumble, I'd be like, you know, come in. You know, and I talked to you like this. That's how I was, and I mumbled, and I barked at people. And if I didn't know you, I didn't fuck with you. People like, what's up? Anywhere I wouldn't speak to them. And I was begging God for some patience and tolerance, and I'll never beg him for patience and tolerance again. But I got this job going door to door like 2 days later, making no money. I'm not even going to say how much money I was making because it was awful. In the middle of June, and I had to wear pants, and I'm walking in these snobby-ass neighborhoods, and these women are coming home from work and cussing me out. These dudes are slamming doors in my face, and there's dogs. And I'm terrified of dogs. And I couldn't say nothing back to these people. And that's how I learned how to be patient and tolerant. Did I get that job by coincidence? No. But at the time, I couldn't put it together. I believed it, but I needed some more proof. You know. And then I carried on into my fourth step, where, like I shared earlier, I admitted a lot of things that I had never admitted to before. You know, there was nothing I just held within myself that no one knew about. But I twisted it around to make it look like I was the victim. I was good at playing the victim. And my fourth step made me look like a victim. And my sponsor said, hell no. And he made me do a lot of it over again. And for me, 4 and 5 is where that obsession was lifted. I remember after 5, I went like a week without thinking about no dope. You know how you fall asleep and you don't realize it, and you wake up and you do like this? I was sitting there one day just chilling, and I jumped, and I said, damn, I ain't thought about drugs in a week. I was, like, touching myself. we went into 6 and 7, man, and I asked God to take my defects away, and I held on to a couple of them, my entitlement, which I never wanted to admit to, you know, the fact that I went to people, and this kid told me this when I was in this treatment center that I later ran away from. He said, Jeter, you walk up to people, and if you don't get what you want, you go on to the next person. And he patted me on the back and he walked away. And I was, I don't know, I was speechless. And it was true. And that's how I was for like the first 10 months of my sobriety. Like, if you didn't have something I wanted, it's like give a mouse a cookie, man. I'm the fucking mouse. Keep giving it to me. And, you know, I later have asked God to help me with those defects, you know, but those defects have been lifted, a lot of them, you know, and they continue to stay lifted as long as I continue to stay connected with God. But let me disconnect myself. Whew. That shit feels ugly. And granted, around this time, the obsession is lifted, and for the first time in my whole entire life, I have some peace of mind. And I can think about one thing at a time. And I can go to sleep before 3 or 4 o'clock at night. I can go to sleep, you know. And I can have a conversation with you and focus on just you. And not think about everything going on in my life. And not be sitting there just waiting to talk. Because there's a difference between listening and waiting to talk. You see what I'm saying? And I was the person who waited to talk, you know. And when I got some peace of mind, that stuff changed. I didn't know I had peace of mind until I lost it, though. You know, and if you know what that means, you've done it before. Because I would drift away from the basics, and my mind would get clouded again, and I'm like, damn, let me get that old feeling back. Because my problems change, but my solution's always the same. I always find my solution from the steps. You know, my sponsor's big. Every time I call him, did you pray about it? Every time. And it's so frustrating. It really is, because I know he's going to say it. And he says it, and he's like, call me after you do it. And I'm like, I want to talk now. But that's you know, my solution to my problems comes somewhere from the steps. And it doesn't matter what problem it is. The problem can change, but the solution never does. You know, then I went into 8 and 9. And I had another God moment when I was doing 8 and 9. You know, I made my list, and I had this kid I played soccer with in college. And boy, we was best friends off the field, but on the field we bumped heads. We both wanted everything our way. We were both real good players. But we did not get along. And I did not want to make amends to him, and my sponsor moved his ass over on them lists. And I got on the MARTA train one day, like 2 days after finishing my 8-step. No, I went to LaGrange after I finished my 8-step, made some amends to my family, then came back, and like 2 days after I was back, I hear this, hey, Jeter. And it was him. And the crazy part about it was, is I get on the train and I'm talking to him, and he said, Jeter, I never ride the train. This is the first time I've ever rode it. I said, if I don't make this amends to him, boy, God's gonna be mad. He's gonna be mad as hell. And I made it, and it wasn't even bad. It went smooth. He's like, no, you don't owe me nothing. You was just doing you. You know, I was rude to you too, and yada, yada, yada. We kept talking, you know what I'm saying? And then I went into 10, you know, when my sponsor taught me what to read every night to keep me on check, to keep me from having to drip back into that fourth. But I don't do that very well, and that's why I'm on another 4-step. But, you know, I haven't reached a point where I've had to pick up a drink, so I must be doing it kind of well, you know what I mean? And then, you know, I went into 11 where I got to learn and try to see God in my life and try to stay conscious with him and try to feel him around me. And, you know, and when I hit 11 is when I started to see all those things that happened, those God moments I've been telling you about, and a couple other things that I'm not going to bore y'all with, but I had some God moments in my life. Then I went into 12, and I'm like, dude, don't nobody want me to be their sponsor. Like, I'm 20 years old, I ain't got no job. I don't drive, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can teach you how to match your hat to your shirt. And that's about it, you know what I'm saying? And I prayed about it, and I was like, you know, I was like, God, if you want me to have a sponsor, you know, put one in my life. And I went to sleep. I didn't get no sponsor. What a surprise. Second day, you know, I prayed, God, you know, if you want me to have a sponsor, put one in my life. The next day, I went to a meeting, and this kid came and asked me to be his sponsor. Didn't even see me raise my hand. Just came and asked me. And I was like, okay. You is there. I'm with you. Like, we down. You know what I'm saying? We are down. And I believed, and I had faith, but I did not understand the power of prayer to a T. You know, and I went back to LaGrange one time for a meeting, and I bumped into my old sponsor, the guy who I told I wasn't done yet, and he said, oh, you back? I said, yeah, I got 6 months, man, you know, I've been through my steps, I'm almost finished, you know, and I finished them at 9, so this is before I finished them, and he said, I've been praying for you every night since you left, and now you're back. And my heart dropped. I didn't know what to say. For a man to take time out of his night to pray for this time I was a 17-year-old kid, for 4 years, three and a half years, every night. Did he do it every night? That's none of my business, but that's what he told me. You see what I'm saying? To pray to his God, who had got him 9, 10 years of sobriety. He must have a powerful God, because that's how I believe I made it back to the rooms. Because I dodged, I don't know how I never came close to overdosing. I don't know how I didn't go to prison, because goddamn, they wanted me in prison bad. Because they was sure enough following my ass. And I don't know how my family stuck by my side with all the hell I put them through, you know? And it's a blessing, man. You know, I honestly, my mother caught the worst of my addiction. You know, I walked all over this woman. You know, she brought me into the world and I stomped all over her and disrespected her. And made her cry on numerous occasions and cussed her out and blamed her for a lot of things. And now I have a relationship with her. My father no longer looks at me as a stranger. You see what I'm saying? You know, I'm in a relationship now where I can actually show a woman respect and try to look at her needs over mine and still be able to speak my mind. You see what I'm saying? You know, I can keep a job. It sucks. But I can keep a job. You know what I mean? And this is a guy who had no ambitions, didn't want to do nothing but play ball and get high, and would snort anything in sight. I walked into my dorm one time, and my roommate had these long-ass lines on the table. I didn't know what it was. I got down there, and I snorted it, and my brain started hurting, and my eyes started watering. And I swear to God, this is the truth. My eye was down here, right? I got one eye up here and one eye down here. And my mouth drooped down. And I like couldn't walk. I couldn't see. I'm like, what was it? He's like, it's an antidepressant, man. I was like, well, at least I'm not depressed anymore. My face hurts. So I got back down there, and my solution was to snort some at the other side so my eyes would be even. And I got down there and I snorted the other line, and the same thing happened to this side of my face. And I told this therapist I was seeing about that, and he was like, you realize you had a mild stroke in your face, don't you? And I was like, no, I thought your whole body. He said, no, a real mild stroke. That's why your eyes sunk. That's why your mouth drooped. That's why your brain hurt. And I'm like, damn. You know what I mean? And I had the times when my heart would skip, and I'd have to, like, catch myself, you know, and the times where I got really hot and driving and not knowing where I was going. And all them times when you hear about people dying. And the guys who come in here and make the same decision and go and take one hit, the same amount we used to do on a daily basis, and it fucking kills them. And it didn't kill me. And I owe that to my God. And I owe that to that man on the graves that prayed for me. And I owe that to my family who kept me in their thoughts. You know what I mean? And I owe the fact that I've never gone back to that to my network, to y'all, to my sponsor, to God. To that gift of surrender, of coming in and not knowing what the fuck to do. Tried everything to get sober, except for the steps at first, and was still going crazy. And then finally tried them and felt better, man, you know? And to have some peace of mind today is a blessing. I would never wish the mental obsession on anyone, anybody. Not my worst enemy, not fucking Osama bin Laden before they killed him. I wouldn't wish that shit on nobody. I'm serious. That's a terrible thing, because we demoralize ourselves for that mental obsession. We do. And when I look back, you know, it's crazy. Some days I'll be sitting there and I won't even be thinking, and somebody will say something, and I'll be like, damn, I used to stay drunk every day. I used to sell drugs, you know. I used to be in jail. I used to weigh 135 pounds. All my ribs showing. Could have washed a shirt on my rib cage. I used to be that, and I'm not today. You know what I'm saying? Because I stay involved. I was in the middle of the alcoholic, drug addict lifestyle, slap in the middle of it. Why would I not get into the middle of this lifestyle? You know? Today, I help out at the treatment center I got sober. You know, I go to multiple treatment centers and go to meetings and speak not really speak. I spoke one time at one, trying to sound cool and shit. But I have to speak at another one, you know, coming up. And I interact with guys, and I sponsor guys. And I throw myself into the middle of this, you know, because I got to. I got to. Because I don't want to go back to that. It's like, okay, you know, if I go back to that, you know, I'll probably go to prison. I'll end up dying eventually. But you die mentally before you die physically. At least somebody like me does. Because I died mentally from the jump. From the jump. That obsession was there from the first drink. And I remember the feeling of the first time I drank on a school night. Like, damn. Like, I'm drinking on a Monday. Like, what the fuck is wrong? You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember that. And that took me to a place where I was getting high to get over the shit I did the day before. You know what I mean? And the never-ending cycle of not wanting to do it, but that's my only solution, and I don't know no better. And not being able to think about nothing but dope and alcohol. And when I did get it, thinking about more dope and alcohol. And thinking about ways to scam people. And never once stopping to think about myself. And I was a alcoholic and a drug addict who could look myself in the mirror. But when I got sober, I couldn't. I remember walking by a mirror one time in treatment, and my eyes were wet red because I couldn't sleep, and I looked high, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, damn, I like the way that looks. Because I ain't like myself. I ain't had no self-worth, no self-respect. You know, I acted like I did. I acted like I was the hottest shit since anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, I came out, motherfuckers was like, damn. But it wasn't like that. That was not the case. You know what I mean? And I'm grateful. You know, I'm truly grateful for some of these guys who come in here and they throw it out there, man, and they get real with you. Because I needed that. I needed somebody to overpower, to overtalk me and be like, look, you don't know nothing. Your shit is raggedy. I hear that on a daily basis. Like, my sponsor told me, I was like, I call him, and he tells me my shit's raggedy, and the phone's just crystal clear. And the one time he told me I was doing good, like, the phone started breaking up, and I'm like, no. No. You know, and I'm so mad that Bob made me do this, but this was a nice experience, man. I've been dodging this for the longest, and, you know, I'm going to end with this. I've gone a little too long, man. I am, you know, really grateful, you know, for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Codependence Anonymous, you know, all 12-step fellowships I attend, and for my sponsorship family, and for my higher power, and for my family, but most of all, for people who have enough interest in what I have to say, for me to remind myself how I used to be, and what I am like now, and then for the people who speak, and I'm like, damn, I ain't got nothing on them, I want to be like them, and then they come and teach me how to do that, they teach me how to grow, and they guide me on that. And they guide me to the solution. And then God works right beside him and guides me into happiness. Thanks for letting me share.